Hi, from Issaquah, Washington, this is Deepak Singh.
And from Cambridge, Massachusetts, this is Hari Jairam.
And you're listening to The Coast.
To Coast.
Bio. Podcast.
Podcast.
Hey, Hari, how are you?
I am very fine, and welcome back to the country.
Thank you.
Been traveling all over the place.
Yeah, I actually took what is this thing called a vacation. Which,
wow, you do those?
Yeah, no, well, apparently not, because the last time I took a vacation was almost exactly 4 years ago.
Wow.
An extended, like, two-week holiday. You know, we've taken a long weekend here or a couple of days here and there over the time, but this is the first extended holiday in a long time. So much needed. Spent time in some lovely parts of Europe, Budapest, Vienna, Venice, the Lake Lucerne area. So it was good. What have you been up to?
I took a short break too. Went out camping over the July 4th weekend, which is a long weekend here in the US, as many of you know. And then, you know, I'd been to a garden conference. There's been a lot of traveling, but all close by to like Maine and so on.
Oh, that's great. And I think I saw a tweet from you about the fact that you'd just come back from camping. About the time I think I came back home, I think you, somewhere along that camping trip, you picked up some allergies, and I'm still not fully recovered from jet lag. So this will be an interesting podcast. If either of us slurs, people will know why.
Or I sneeze like uncontrollably midway during our conversation.
Yeah.
I apologize in advance.
Yeah, and it's been an interesting week. So Saifu just ended a few minutes ago, I guess, a few hours ago.
It
was over the weekend, and I just saw tweets from people saying they're catching planes to go back and things like that. And Nat Talkington was talking about needing a big bag to carry all the swag back. And I told him if he didn't have a big bag, he could send it all to me.
They actually give out swag still. I thought like all the green movement has caught on at conferences and they just decided like no more swag or something like that.
Yeah, well, I think most people, it's nothing to do with being green. It has to do with not having enough money.
Probably, you're right.
Yeah. And before Saifu, you had Science Barcamp Palo Alto, which judging by the friend feed chatter went really, really well. And unfortunately, it clashed with the one time in the year that I could take time off. Otherwise, I would have most certainly been there.
And what's the Cybar Camp? I thought there was one in Cambridge, UK as well. Or was I just mixing my feeds up?
No, there's a bunch of bar camps. There's a Science Bar Camp in Toronto. There's a Science Bar Camp. I forget what the exact bar camp in Cambridge, UK. And this is the one that last year, Attila Chordash, I guess, was the main person behind it. It was BioBarCamp this year. I think Attila and I had sort of talked about it, and I didn't really do. I sort of had the early idea. Attila was the one who actually went with it, organized it, got things going. I think Shirley and other people in the Bay Area helped out. And this year was the second edition, and they extended it and made it a science bar camp. And people like Jamie McQuay, who organizes the Toronto event, was involved in this as well. And again, they had it the day before, 2 days before Saifu, so that people who are attending Saifu, if they came earlier, they could attend that as well. So people like Cameron were there for both, I think. And it looked like it went really well. It was a pretty, you even had people like Dr. Kiki and other people show up. So,
Really?
Yeah, interesting. Again, it was the Institute for the Future that they had it. One of these days, either this one, actually more appropriately for the Science Online, next year in North Carolina, we both should show up with our recording equipment and just do live podcasting.
That'll be awesome. Now that more or less finished most of my postdoc projects, I think I'll be able to travel at will. So yeah, we should definitely do that. That'll be a lot of fun, I'm sure.
Yeah, and I was actually thinking about it. I forget when I was thinking about it, but the thought came to mind that, you know, we should definitely, you know, a couple of webcams and definitely the recording equipment. We should do interviews and do just live, I was thinking about Coast to Coast Bio and you know, the fact that we started interviewing people reminded me a little bit of Net at Night with Leo and Amber MacArthur, and even some episodes of Stack Overflow or Floss Weekly, for
that
matter.
Right, exactly.
Yeah, on all the Floss Weekly, they always have somebody else on. So Net at Night, I think, or Stack Overflow fit this format better, where there's not always a guest involved. Go ahead.
No, I started listening to Stack Overflow religiously. When we started at episode one, I just about, you know, used the site and I never even listened to the podcast. And then in the last, I think this summer, pretty much in the last month, I've heard almost all their episodes, even the back episodes. It's a great podcast.
I mean, in fact, if you remember when we started Coast to Coast Bio, I was sort of inspired by Stack Overflow because Stack Overflow podcast started off with, I guess, Joel and
Jeff Atwood.
They used to talk every weekend, and they sort of converted that into their podcast. And of course, it's evolved since they started, but I was thinking about what Amber and Leo do with Net at Night, where they do links of the week, they talk about stories, and they'll bring a guest on to talk about something interesting. And when they also end up doing live events, when they're at a conference together, Leo carries his whole equipment along. I think Science Online in North Carolina would be a great place to do that.
Right. No, we should definitely plan to go to that. And, there's a bunch of bar camps and so on in Cambridge, U.S. as well, which let's see if we can catch up, and make one of those. That'll be cool too.
Yeah, no, I'm definitely. I mean, I think the problem is with work and everything, scheduling can get really hard. But the North Carolina event, I haven't missed it. I attended last 2 years. I don't plan to miss it this year as well. Luckily, it's at that time of the year, early January, when things aren't really. You can still take a day or two off, and it's mostly over the weekend, so you don't lose. You know, it's not like middle of the year; you either take a break or things at work are so hectic that it's tough to just sort of disappear for a few days. It's something that we should think about. I'm sure I can suggest it to Bora. I don't know how we would do it, but we should definitely do a session on podcasting.
Yeah, that'll be really cool. Yeah. And actually, along these lines, thanks to everyone for all the positive feedback we got about the interview episode 21 with Ricardo Vidal. That was the first time we tried, an interview, and a lot of people sent in a few good words. So that was nice to hear.
Yeah, that's encouragement is always good, and I think that by far that's not going to be our last interview. And we'll keep experimenting with, what we can do with Coast to Coast Bio. I mean, obviously, given schedules, getting everything right and the timing and all is difficult. But interviews, I think, will definitely happen.
Exactly. Cool. So, we have quite a few stories, despite Atom's hectic travels all through Europe and my allergied week. We have a few stories. So, Atom, you want to set the ball rolling?
Let's just jump into them. And the first one's actually an old article that I think Chris Lasher, somebody put it up, or maybe you did, on our Delicious page. And I put it up here because it's an old article, but it's one that's really good. It's one that I've written before. And it talks about, the basis of the story is Brian Greene getting a letter from an American soldier who talks about a book helping him out there in that environment, and the book is on science. The book is one which traces their search for sort of nature's deepest laws. And the fact that this book was helping a soldier out in Iraq was where it came from. And I think that's sort of the genesis of the story. The real story is about the fact that the author says that the American education system fails to teach science in a way, and I'm quoting here, that allows students to integrate it into their lives. I think it's a theme that I've written about, people talk about all the time. It comes up on various blogs and friend feed and Twitter. education, science, the public, that gap between the public and science as it's taught, and science as it's taught in universities, and science as it is conveyed to the public. And what Brian Greene argues for is that science is a way of life, and you want to make it part of life, and you want to make people sort of see the beauty of it. And it's not just about looking at stars and astronomy, but in general. And I wanted to sort of get your take on, where you stood on this issue and what you thought was, having not been educated here, neither of us can really comment on it, but I guess, I mean, in detail, with any sort of depth, in-depth knowledge, but sort of in general, what do you think?
Well, yeah, I think it's true everywhere, you hear just about every country complaining about how enrollment in science courses, whether it's chemistry, biology, I mean, I'm not talking even engineering courses, the applied stuff is going down, and people just aren't picking these disciplines to pursue. And this is, we're talking later in life. I mean, even it starts early, and even as like high school and K through 12, there is a general perception that the scientific fiber of all our countries is not really as good as it was. I don't know, it's strangely, I start to feel optimistic more now, and I think it's kind of, it's strange, but it's, I think there is something like a trickle down effect from up there, with all the consciousness over global warming and all the stuff that's going on now. I just feel that with, I'm not crediting this for to the new administration or something, but considering that you hear about science and science policy a lot more now, I think the overall what do you call level of exposure amongst people is increasing rather than going down. I was listening to the TWIV podcast, which I do regularly, and they are, just as an example, their listener base is pretty big, and they get people like carpenters and like all sorts of people from all sorts of walks of life writing in saying, I've never really found science as interesting as after I've started listening to that particular podcast. And I think, as if you're curious, you can find it now. And I think that's, in a way, yeah, sure, education's broken, and there's a lot of people who are trying to fix it. But in a way, the curious still, just like the soldier who started looking at the skies and had this book that was a source of solace out there. I think it's actually improving in the sense that if you are even remotely interested in something, there's a lot of very like good stuff rises to the top, and people find their things that make them tick. Like I think in a way, like the whole maker, what's that, the make movement is a example of that. How many of those makers are like engineers? Not many. And I think actually I'm optimistic, and I think the overall consciousness now is improving. Of course, yeah, you still probably it's the education per se is still broken, but
I mean,
yeah.
I think, but it goes down deeper to that, and maybe it's just cynicism or whatever. Actually, there's a real interesting anecdote from my flight yesterday. There was I guess a guy with traveling with his sons or whatever, and his son was asking, son must be in a few years, 5, 6 years old, was asking questions along the lines of, why, how does a plane fly? And instead of from random answer, the dad actually talked to him about Bernoulli's principle, about
Wow.
pressure and how it goes.
Yeah.
And I think that's what's needed. I think the fundamentals, what's missing and what we've lost, is this overemphasis on applied science to some extent. I think at an early age, sort of when the curiosity and sort of how science makes things work in general is what's is not being conveyed properly. It's just my feeling. It's not just in the classroom, but it's in like general science magazines and textbooks. It
Right.
tends to all be about the home run or saving cancer or curing cancer and correcting global warming, rather than trying to explain to people what makes things hot, what makes things cold.
I see what you're talking about.
Yeah,
So you're
it's the
saying
very
like,
funda
you know,
very the
the
very
fo yeah.
fundamentals that that sort of make things tick. What's the cell? How is our knowledge? I mean, what we knew about biology when we were kids and what's there now is completely different in many ways. In some ways, it's exactly the same. In other ways, it's completely changed.
Like, I actually heard, you know, some engineer friends of mine who were asking me after they read the Singularities Near book, you know.
Oh, God.
Exactly, right? I mean, that's the kind... I know what you're talking about because you have people who actually believe that, you know, we'll be able to, like, figure all this stuff out and then whatever, how many ever years away from the singularity we are. And that's because you have a lack of fundamental concept of how intricate things are. I see what you're talking about, you know.
Well, talking of the singularity, it's kind of funny because I think there's a Singularity University in the Bay Area and the place where Science Barcamp has helped. It's kind of involved with that as well. But I forget who called this. Somebody called the Singularity Singularity Intelligent Definition for those with IQ levels over... Intelligent Design for those with IQs over 140. And but the best one, I think, came from Derek Lowe, who writes In the Pipeline. And we'll have an In the Pipeline story later in this podcast. But Derek talks about, you know, the... science and the people who are very pessimistic, the people who are pragmatic, and they say super optimists who think the singularity will fix everything.
Exactly.
I
see what you're saying. You're basically saying, you know, like fundamentally there are a lot of things that are wrong, but I think that's really hard, and that's
that sort of beauty of science is being lost. You know, when we were. And that's what I really appreciated about this dialogue on the plane, where this dad's sort of explaining generally. He didn't start out by saying this is why a plane flies. He talked about if you have two objects and this pressure is different underneath versus above, things with, you know, and he talked about fluid flow and stuff like that without going into the gory technical details. But he explained it at a high level and talked about why things work and then talked about the wing design.
Right.
And that's, I think, what's... we got from our parents, and I think we got from books that we read as we were kids. And
correct.
You know,
and there's not that much.
And apparently, you know, it's not being taught in school. I don't know. I didn't go to school here. So
forget school, right? Even when you look at like the Learning Channel and stuff like that, right? Yeah. I mean, talk of degeneration of like good opportunities, right? You had these. I remember even like 5 years back when I used to watch TV, the Learning Channel had shows like, I mean, yeah, they probably do have one show now, says how things work, but that's how the whole network was. But now 90% of the shows on there are like, you know, how to make over your house and how not to dress. I think that's on a Learning Channel. I mean,
worse than that, don't they have the show called John and Kate Plus 8 or something like that?
I don't know. Yeah, it's, you know,
yeah, I almost fell out of my chair when I heard that.
I, you know, before I used to think, TLC, that's kind of, is that the Learning Channel? Okay, now it looks like it's like Tender Love and Care or some stupid other, you know, apology for the Learning Channel. No, exactly. No, I see what you're talking about.
It's like MTV doesn't play music anymore, right?
Right.
anyway. No, it's interesting, and I don't know what the answer is. I quite frankly, I think a lot of it, it's not about school. It's about general...
curiosity
and also I think scientists don't do a good job of, we sort of made science this very abstract, complex, you know, so we've sort of forgotten what the beauty of science is. I hear more people complaining about school and publications and this and that these days for good reason in many cases, but we sort of lost it. I think lost some of that reason why most of us end up becoming scientists is because we actually love, you know, what it means. So I also had this very interesting discussion last week when we were in Switzerland. We visited some friends, and the guy is an astroparticle physicist. So he does astroparticle physics. It's not a field which you do just because you're going to make a lot of money, or you're going to have this funky career. You do it because you enjoy it.
Correct.
And he was talking about the kind of experiments they were doing, and you could make out that fellow actually is very cares about this. And I think when you're doing a field like, I think that's why when I always find particle physics is very interesting, because their entire life is based on figuring out how fundamental things work.
Right. Hey, astroparticle physics, that's like all these like, you know, neutrinos. And I mean, is that physics?
Yeah, it's particles at dust, but you know, like some radiation in space.
I see.
And stuff like that. Yeah.
So they use like Chandra and all these telescopes.
No, he's actually making he's making a telescope. That's his project.
Oh, I see.
For the kind of events that they are looking for are events that happen once in 100 years.
Right. Don't we have like not particle physics, but kind of like astronomy to credit for the discovery of like Buckminster Fullerene and stuff, weren't they?
I believe so.
They were trying to study like some IR signature by simulating it with like soot, and that's how they came up with the whole thing. I mean, at least part of the discovery. I think that's what, right? The connectedness of things people just miss, and every time when I find something that makes these connections obvious. Oh, for example, actually, since we're down this road. So I was at Acadia National Park, right? And I saw this whole display on DDT. So, you know, how like DDT is killed a lot of the a lot of the birds of prey, especially like peregrine falcons and a whole bunch of the eagles and so on in this country. I think the bald eagle as well was a severe victim of DDT poisoning in the 60s because of the extensive spraying. And there was a beautiful display of, you know, how DDT caused eggshells to thin and so on. Anyway, why I'm bringing this up is like the connectedness of like science, right? Like, I always like this great example, like in India now, of the vultures. There's this antibiotic called Diclofenac, which they use on cattle. And it took like a team of guys who researched vultures. So the vultures were dying off. Nobody knew how. They looked at DDT, but it didn't seem like it was the same kind of effect. And then, you know, it just took a whole bunch of guys to like look at a whole bunch of dead vultures. And then they made the connection to an antibiotic used in cattle. And I think that was, now there's an active ban. Anyway, but the connectedness between, you know, some guy researching diclofenac, which is the antibiotic, another guy researching like gout in vultures, and a third guy researching like declining vultures populations, right? So now you have this whole thing, and now they're actually using other antibiotics in cattle because vultures die, because cattle eat that dye, and the vultures prey on the dead cattle. Anyway, so the connectedness is what we all lose, and you know how small things like are connected to whole other effects. And I just feel that every time a new example like this comes up, there are a lot of science gets better. And all we can hope for is that more of these things happen.
It's something that John O'Dell and I talked about when he made the mistake of interviewing me. Was that, you know, how do you make science more accessible? And I think one of the ways that we can do it is, now that there's so many of us, which is why I like Shirley's blogging so much.
Right.
Because she's very accessible. Most of us are not. She is.
Right.
You know, it's people like her, when they start writing for newspapers or people start following their blogs, or, you know, somebody chances upon it, you start learning a lot. And I think a lot of the, this is really interesting and this is really cool and I wish I could find out more about it will come from there.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Actually, speaking of Shirley Wu, and that is an awesome post that she had about the letter to Jenny McCarthy about the whole, you know, how Jenny McCarthy is against vaccines because she thinks they cause autism. And this is a topic that, again, the TWIV talks a lot about. And there's this really cool bunch of papers recently about whole genome. There's been a whole bunch of
Jiva stuff on that, right?
But now the new stuff is like pretty darn clear that there's a very strong genetic basis. And they looked at a huge number of children with autism and like families that have autism. And now they have like 5 or 6 gene candidates and they seem pretty, you know, they're all closely involved in like neuronal patterns and stuff. And it's really, really cool stuff. And, you know, exactly, right? I mean, thanks to scientists who blog and are good at communicating now, it's at least a few more people get the message. And maybe we'll never have the reach of Jenny McCarthy. But maybe, you know, slowly but surely, you never know.
and that's, again, it speaks to my point about Shirley specifically, because the way she wrote it can be understood by most people.
Right.
She's not writing it to scientists. She's writing it to a general public. And she has the capability of sort of balancing that scientific integrity of it with making it very accessible in the way she writes, which is why I think, you know, I think she's the best of all the bloggers out there today, at least in, especially in sort of communicating some of these things. So, yeah, and I think it's going to take a mix of people in that, people like that, and, you know, people writing in the popular media press. And also, I think general, our approach, you know, people being interested in science, just frustrates me that the only time, you know, people will talk about global, even people who talk about climate change, both plus, for, and against, half of them don't know what the hell they're talking about. And they don't understand the science behind it. And most of the time, it's not simple. But if you understand the basics and you appreciate the basics, you know, you never know. Anyway, that was a good start. I think we talked about this for about a good 15, 20 minutes.
Oh, wow. Okay, good.
So let's move on to our next topic. What I wanted to talk about was a blog post by Jim Hendler on his blog on Nature Network, where he talks about a recent NSF grant which didn't get funded. And the title of the blog post is "Why NSF Cannot Fund High-Risk, High-Reward Research." But before I go there, do you know who Jim Hendler is?
No.
So Jim Hendler is actually quite well-known. He's not a blogger. If you look at his profile over there, it'll probably tell you a little bit more about who he is. He recently moved to Rensselaer Polytechnic. He is one of the best known people in the semantic web. He is, along with the Tim Berners-Lees of the world, on the academic forefront of the semantic web, and has always been. He also has the best title in the history of mankind. His position is the Tetherless World Chair of Computer and Cognitive Science. He's made a large name for himself from his time at the University of Maryland. So he's an extremely well-known person in that space. He's been doing this for a very long time. And the blog post essentially talks about some of the limitations and challenges with NSF and funding high-risk science. I don't know if you had a chance to read it, but I know you don't go apply to the NSF for funding, and then NIH's mechanisms might be slightly different, but I was wondering what your opinions on this were, since you are in the world where you have to apply for funding to a funding agency, a federal funding agency like the NSF or the NIH. Oh, you're Howard Hughes. Maybe you don't have to do that.
Well, we have a fair bunch of NIH grants as well in the lab, and we're fortunate enough that funding's been good actually, and maybe that's why I'm going to come out sounding optimistic here. I think this keeps going on, and I think in a way, the part that I didn't like. I thought this was a very good post, and this plagues both the NIH and NSF, I'm sure, is this tendency to go for the safe stuff and not go for the risky, you know? And that's really kind of hurt science, I guess, in this country. You know, we've harped on for quite a few episodes about how, I at least hate this whole push to big science, you know, and genomic medicine. And it's kind of the same thing. Like, a lot of priorities seem to have got reset in the recent past. And that's really hurt science. And I agree with a lot of what, I cursorily read this post, of course. But I don't know. I think this is one of those things that it keeps going on, and there's really nothing you can do because money is finite. And some things happen that shouldn't, and I guess we just have to grin and bear it. You know, it's never going to not be like this. Yeah. I think, okay, along these lines, some good things happen, like the Howard Hughes, right? They started this ultra risky grant funding thing where you get 5 years of Hughes funding. You're not a Hughes investigator, but you're like a early career Hughes, and the idea is to fund risky projects, and apparently they've done a very good job. These are all young PIs, so not the old guard and, you know, established guard, young PIs who get a lot of money for 5 years, and they can possibly apply for full-time use funding at the end of 3 years having this 5-year thing, and once at the end of 5 years. But at the end of 5 years, they're cut off. They cannot get this money again. And it really allows people to do risky stuff. And I think, yeah, that's happening, I think, with this whole like stimulus and I don't know. But
yeah,
it's changing.
I think to some extent, Jim's point is more to do with the process of, because he proposes some ideas, or at least talks about, points to a few specific issues with the NSF funding process. Actually, number three was the one that seemed to resonate the most with me, is that he says all of NSF reviewing now is done by panels. Mm-hmm. I think NIH is also, I don't know where
entirely
NIH is.
Entirely done by panels.
It's all panels, right? The study sections.
Yep.
And Michael Nielsen points it out in the comments there as well. It says there's actually enough study out there. It says panels tend to be a lot more conservative than individual reviewers, outside, third-party reviewers. And I think that makes a lot of sense to me. And I agree that outside review is a very time-consuming process, and it's, people can get overloaded. But, I think it's sort of like peer review. Grants are such a fundamental part of what we do.
Mm-hmm.
I think we need to go away from, panels voting to sort of an unbiased approach to scoring, having reviewers look at it and making their recommendations and sort of then coming up with a way of looking at papers, because looking at grants. And I think if we are willing to be peer reviewers, we have to be willing to be grant reviewers as well, because it's such an important part of what's happening.
I don't know. I don't think the panel system, I think that's a great way to do things, actually. And almost, I mean, if you can't convince, how many ever, I guess in a study section, there's probably like at least three people. I think they're actually slightly bigger. And if you can't convince, three people, it's okay if they're more conservative. But I think that's part of the process, and I don't think it needs to change. I really think that most people I know who've written grants that I thought I would fund have actually managed to get funding over the last, four plus years I've been a postdoc. So
yeah.
I don't know why I'm sounding so positive, but I'm serious. Like,
yeah.
I really, stuff happens, People do end up, but on the whole, maybe the day my first grant gets denied or something, I'll probably write a similar post. But anyway.
Yeah, I mean, I know enough people who haven't had grants. I mean, I was lucky in grad school also. One, we had all our NIH grants funded.
Right.
Plus, we had this huge pot of a few million dollars from the Air Force, which is why I never had to TA. And neither did most of the people in the lab, because we were just well funded.
Right.
Which the rest of the department hated us for that. Yeah. But it's interesting. I mean, I do definitely, this whole discussion on panels is the part that actually very interesting.
At the recent Biophysical Society meeting that I attended, right, they had a bunch of these mock panels. And it was very interesting the way these things are done, because they are your peers, and if you can't convince your peers, your peers are conservative. I mean, of course, you're basically in there to critically review this thing, and you might tend to be very conservative, and that's okay. I guess risky stuff falls by the wayside. That's, I guess, Jim Hendler's point.
Yeah, and that's Michael Nielsen's point as well.
He
actually points to some books where there's an analysis of where say group decision making performs poorly when decisions are being made about questions whose answer is relatively subjective, and the group behavior is relatively unstructured.
Right.
The
standard way to do that is to write a safe grant and do the risky research using the money from that safe grant.
That's kind
because
of how
the one thing the NIH doesn't force you to do is to work on exactly what you said you would work on. Once you get the money, it's yours. You can do the craziest thing and crash and burn. All that means is that 5 years from then, you will get your grant renewed. But 5 years from then, if you do something super risky and it works, you're going to get a grant funded again.
I think in this case, the challenge is that there's like 30 people involved. So it was an interesting read because it's a fairly he goes into sort of the specific issues, and you know, the fact that Jim Hendler definitely caught my eye. Sort of moving on from that is a blog post that I think you, I don't know if you got a chance to read it, but I got a nice kick out of it. Derek Lowe writes one of my favorite blogs. It's a blog that's almost exclusively focused on medicinal chemistry and the pharmaceutical industry. But he has a blog post from, I guess, last week, which he says, which the title is Jargon Will Save Us All. I don't know if you had a chance to read it, but if you read it, you'll have no idea what the person he's. So he basically points to a BioIT World article where there's this fellow who works for some capital management company or whatever, has an article which says, only Moore's Law can save Big Pharma. And Derek says, I have read it 3 times now and I still have only the vaguest idea what it's talking about. And let's see if all of you can do better. I said, sure, you know, I'm less conservative than Derek and I'm not a medicinal chemist and I do think computational stuff has got a lot of value. And after I read it, I'm like, what the hell is this guy talking about? So he calls drug discovery today faith-based drug discovery. And yeah, he states some of the very obvious thing. He says the only way to escape this downward spiral is new science. Fortunately, the fuzzy outlines of a revolution are just emerging. For lack of a better word, let's call it digital chemistry. Okay. At least he didn't call it chemistry 2.0. And he says, he talks about, and then he goes further. He says, tomorrow's the drug companies will build rationally engineered multi-component molecular machines, not small molecule drugs isolated from tree bark or bread mold. What crap? Not everybody's doing natural products chemistry.
I think this guy has read The Singularities Now.
Yeah, that's exactly. Yeah. I don't even know what to say. Yeah. It's just amazing that somebody actually got away with writing that article in BioIT World.
Oh, goodness. You know, this. Did you see Alex Greekspor actually pointed this article on... what is that? Some UK, the Register. I don't know. It's like a dig clone or something, I guess. Yeah.
But the Register is a newspaper. Yeah.
It's a newspaper? Okay.
Yeah, the Register is actually a...
is it the like, Daily Mirror and the Sun and
No, it's actually... It's a fairly well-respected newspaper, I
see.
Think.
But
did you see
that article? I mean, it was about how TechCrunch did not know what they were talking about when they were reviewing... The new Chrome OS that came out. It kind of sounds
well,
like
the Register always goes after TechCrunch.
I kind of got that drift, but it is along the same lines. Anyway, I digress. But no, I agree. I mean, you read this stuff and you're like, what the hell is BioIT World doing by publishing this stuff?
I like BioIT World. They publish good stuff, but this is ridiculous. I'm just trying to understand what he's talking about, and jargon is all over the place, but it's not even jargon that makes sense. So, as you said, very quite honestly, he's read The Singularities Near, but seriously, I mean, obviously, all of us would agree that the drug industry has a problem, but you know, I think the solution lies not just in our methods, because I think we are in this sort of we are in this state where we are going from a world where drugs were made a certain way and you've found most of the ones that you can. The knowledge that you have with these new techniques is not complete. You're still evolving.
Right.
And we're sort of in this intermediate stage. And I think it's going to take about 10 or 15 years or so before we figure it out, sort of what the next approach wave of how we approach drug development will be.
Right. I have a question, though. The one thing I do kind of get the feeling for, of course, I don't follow the drug industry as closely as you do, but biologics are getting very big. I mean, you know, yeah, it just seems like, I'm not sure whether it's driven by like profits or because we all know every biologic out there you pay like in 4 digits for.
But yeah.
It seems like almost like whole companies now seem to suddenly say, you know, all our small molecule, you know, libraries, whatever. I mean, they're all old hat now. Now let's just go make antibodies. Let's just go make, you know, protein-based and siRNA-based.
Yeah, I still a small percentage, though.
It's still, well, that's good, actually. I mean, no, but so I guess, you know, you read an article like this, and it seems like everybody's jumping onto the biologics bandwagon, and that just sounds scary because it's throwing the baby out of the bathwater is the last thing we need to do, you know. And I don't know, it just seems like everybody seems to be going more after biologics. I don't know much about drug industry pipelines right now, but if that's true, I think we're all in trouble because...
No, I am pretty sure that you know, biologics are a component of most people's portfolios, but for the bigger companies that have diverse portfolios, they're just, you know, I think Pfizer's shutting down its biologics unit in the Bay Area, the BBC facility, or at least I have to go confirm that story, but I think, I'm pretty sure I read something about it. So yeah, I mean, small molecule chemistry still is what makes things tick. I think what we need to figure out is what we, you know, we all know that the single target, single molecule thing is not going to work long term.
Right, yeah. Magic bullets are a thing of...
Well, there's no such thing as a magic bullet.
Exactly.
Right?
And we finally kind of, I guess, are starting to realize
and
that.
I agree that there was a lot of trial and error, but there was a lot of systematic trial and error in what drugs did. The complexity lies in the fact that in vivo studies and animal studies don't translate to human all the time. You know, and you have patents to worry about, and you have to worry about side effects, and you have to worry about labels. I think we don't have enough knowledge right now to go away from targeting, you know, single target to single, to targeting pathways and off-target effects and so on and so forth. You know, when we figure that out and how to actually control that, then we'll be fine. But it's going to take a while. I do think that the blockbuster is going to go away. I think it should go away. And unfortunately, it's going to take a lot of time for the industry to sort of figure out how to, what the new business models and incentive models should be.
So you think we'll have like the long tail of the drug industry where, you know, you'll have many, many, many small things that kind of end up adding to revenues for a company?
Yeah, I mean, I mean, maybe this is my pipe dream and me being utopian, but I always felt that that where we'll end up is companies having sort of having a portfolio of drugs, that sort of where you have a family that's targeting one particular disease with different type of sort of effect profiles. So you won't have one drug targeting diabetes; you'll have a family of drugs sort of sub-targeting. And then you'll have sort of, you'll have an approach where you make very smart bets, where you don't depend on one drug, but you have this family of drugs that because your risk goes down and how you manage risk and how you develop the drug. So, you know, it's, people say it costs you $1 billion to make a drug, but that's a risk in it, right? The cost of $1 billion is the includes all the failures that you have. And I think the goal is to figure out how to reduce those failures. So you'll have this sort of portfolio of drugs. You won't have a single $20 billion drug, but you'll have several $100 million drugs.
Right.
But to make that work, you have to reduce that cost risk part of it. And I think that's where we'll eventually end up being successful.
Absolutely. Cool. So should we switch to the next funny thing? The Web 2.0 story, or?
Yeah, why don't we talk about it? It's from Ewan, so why don't we just talk about it? The Streamosphere, which is very interesting. So Ewan does all these funky projects. So he has this new project called the Streamosphere, which does a real-time stream of information that's going on the, you know, discussions that are going on in the quote-unquote real-time web, friend feed, Twitter, things like that. Have you had a chance to even play
with
it?
Yeah, it seems to be like an aggregator like friend feed, but of like a select bunch. He said around 4K, that looks like 4,000 different feed sources, right? And I checked out the interface and stuff. It's pretty neat. It looks exactly like FriendFeed. That's my only comment, you know. So in that sense, I like FriendFeed a lot, and I use it almost exclusively now. And the Streamosphere seems like FriendFeed. Am I right, or is it?
Yeah, I think just going by Ewan's blog post, I think it's a, quite honestly. I mean, the Streamosphere is a concept project, right? It's not a formal
nature
thing.
Right,
it's Ewan likes trying out new ideas, as he calls it. It's a pre-alpha alpha. Mm-hmm. So it's a meta aggregator. It's taking discussions on FriendFeeding, discussions on Twitter, wherever, but slicing off the scientific discussion out of it and sort of taking all the discussion around a particular... It's more based on a topic, right? It's sort of the idea that of a meme. It's more like a real-time meme tracker. Mm-hmm. Sort of what was the site that you developed before?
Scintilla?
No, well, Scintilla is part of it, but more along the lines of the one that was like tech meme. I forget the name of it now that Ewan did. But whatever, it's more like a real-time version of, streaming version of that, where mm-hmm. you have stories being discussed on the web and sort of clustering around that particular story and who's talking about it and so on. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's a cool concept, I think. But it's nice to see these small projects, you know. But I haven't played with it much to really have any more of an opinion than it seemed like FriendFeed right now.
Yeah, it's definitely very much like FriendFeed. And I think part of the reason is that a lot of the discussion that's picking up is coming from FriendFeed.
Right.
Because FriendFeed has so much of the activity going on. But so I think a lot of it is coming from there. But I do find it interesting that what it links to is not the story on FriendFeed, but the actual original story.
Right. It goes into the it doesn't mirror FriendFeed in that sense. Right. I see what you're saying. No, I must say, like, I'm so addicted to just using FriendFeed now that it's difficult to change away from that, you know. And I remember before that, you know, I used to read blogs and, you know, stuff like that. But now, just about the only thing I get time to read now is FriendFeed. And, of course, from FriendFeed, I launch into reading blogs and so on. I don't even use Google Reader anymore. I've become like a huge FriendFeed junkie. That's about the only thing I use now.
Yeah, I actually cleaned out my Google Reader a lot from having hundreds of feeds. Now I have about 25 to 30 because I don't want mm-hmm. to miss them.
Right.
Basically, the feeds where I find very unique, interesting information, things mm-hmm. that I know that I'll find on FriendFeed, mm-hmm. I don't subscribe to anymore.
Right.
There are a few blogs that I will subscribe to, Neil, Shirley's, that Cameron's, that I don't want to miss any stories.
Right.
But in general, in the tech world especially, now I go to specific programming blogs, but because those are not the kind of things that, bubble up to the top all the time.
Right,
So that I can maybe share some interesting stuff with other people. But yeah, FriendFeed has made a huge impact on how I consume information.
Right, same here. Yeah, I don't even use... I use Twitter, of course, but nowadays, you know, FriendFeed mirrors even Twitter so perfectly that
I do think Twitter is absolutely amazing, and I use it especially for work. When I use Twitter as a communication system,
right exactly.
Quite a bit.
Yeah.
But also, let's say Amazon releases a new feature, AWS mm-hmm. releases a new feature. I monitor some keywords on Twitter. And it's the best real-time...
Meme tracker.
It's not meme tracker, in feedback. So, like, let's you release Elastic MapReduce for something, what people think about it, whether people are excited by it.
Yeah.
Just sitting there and watching for 2 hours, it's just fascinating.
That's cool, I can see that, right?
Yeah,
and one of these days, you should go into the tools you use for that, because I don't do much of that. Of course, I don't need to keep track of what anybody's saying other than, you know, about the few papers I write and stuff. But yeah, it's really cool that I guess you do that, right? You have like TweetDeck and so on, and you just watch this live stream of the buzz out there. All the news stations are doing it too, I guess. But
it's kind of crazy how much the news stations are doing it. ESPN is carrying live tweeting now from somebody watching basketball games.
Goodness.
So it talk about jumping the shark, right? Apparently, the BBC has caught on as well.
Oh, goodness.
As Andrew Walkinshaw just had something posted where somebody in the BBC was pitching his Twitter handle left, right, and center. What I like about this is, one, I really like the way Yoon tries out things.
Yeah, and no, that's really awesome. Right?
Yeah. Post-Genomic is the one I was thinking about, his previous, previous project. And this is kind of like Post-Genomic, but in real time. Because, again, it's not linking to the story on FriendFeed, it's actually linking to the source article. And then capturing all the discussion around it. It just happens that most of it seems to be on FriendFeed at this point of time.
Right. Actually, hey, do you know how many subscribers or how many people are on the Life Scientist room in FriendFeed? You started that room, right?
So I started. I can go check. I don't know if it's easy to do so.
Because at least a C2C bio room, we know exactly how many people are on there. So. No, I'm just curious for that because didn't Chris Lasher also have a link he'd sent along about, like, it had like percentages of
growth. Twitter. So 981 subscribers for the Life Scientist.
That's almost awesome, actually. That's almost 1,000. That's pretty cool. I mean, and I really think, it's
hey,
it's,
yeah, we have more subscribers in the Hadoop room.
Oh, really? Wow.
Yeah.
Well, of course, you get every developer who's working on like Amazon and stuff. You probably have a ton of people there. This points to the whole John Wilbanks and others thing about the, you know, the few percent of the few percent.
Yeah.
But you know, unlike like in if just about every let's say 10 to 20% of people who subscribe to my Twitter feed now seem to be let's just say non-bona fide people who would have any interest in what I say. Like, if you're scantily clad and you follow me, you probably are following the wrong person.
Yeah.
Only because
you never know.
Most of my posts are about, like, Linux and Python, so your priorities are in the wrong place. No, that's why. I think Twitter has more than jumped the shark, right? It's like there's so much spam following going on there.
Yeah, but the good news is that because you don't have to follow back,
Right. Actually, I started actively blocking people. Now
I actively block as well.
If you send me an email about which took 2 seconds of my time, I'm going to block you just so you know that everybody's not dumb enough to follow you back.
The thing is that I normally don't. I bulk return follow. I don't have to respond. I normally go back after every 2 days and see who started following me.
I don't do that.
And by that time, normally the more blatant spammers, they'll already have been suspended.
I see. Okay.
I partly started doing it for that reason. Because it takes Twitter about 48 hours to catch on.
Okay. I see.
To somebody. Yeah.
Nowadays, I find I get almost 50% spam followers. And anyway, that must just be, I don't know what sites I visit that I get all these spam followers. But anyway. Cool.
Yeah. Yeah, so those are sort of the formal stories we had, and we've been recording now for almost an hour. So why don't we jump straight to our links of the week?
Perfect. Sounds good. Okay, I've actually. You want to go first? Go ahead.
I am going to cheat. I have two links of the week.
Sure.
My first link of the week is a podcast called Tech Zing. Have you had a chance to? Have you had a chance to check it out?
No, I haven't.
So TechZing, I forget where I heard about it. Somewhere.
It looks like a JavaScript-y kind of podcast.
No, so where's it gone? I can't find the site now.
TechZingLive.com, is that the one?
Yeah, I think so. TechZing podcast is TechZingLive.com. Yes, so I remember I heard about it because of podcast number... I think it got discussed in. It got discussed in the podcast we discussed earlier today. Sorry, my brain is Stack Overflow. I got into it with podcast number 5, where they talk about You Had Me at Erlang.
Oh wow, that sounds like a cool title.
Yeah. So Stack Overflow, episode number 2 was called Stack Overflow Hurt My Feelings Again. And now, like stack number 9 is about jQuery. Number 8 is about databases, or about the Cassandra project from Facebook. It's a really good podcast. I really recommend this because I have been hearing
a lot of Stack Overflow. But this sounds cool, actually. Source control. What's source control? That's episode 3. Huh, nice. And what's your other link?
My other link is something that popped up today. It's a website that's been started by Bosco Ho. If you've been following FriendFeed this evening, you've probably seen it because a bunch of us commented on it. So Bosco wrote a blog post which has a really cool title, which goes, "Heat a residue in a protein, large loops pop out." It talks about his research and everything that he's been doing on molecular dynamics, but he's created a website for his work now for rotamerically induced perturbations. It's at It's at Bosco, BOSCOH.com/RIP, R-I-P. And it has some great pictures, some great animations. It's a method that generates perturbations that are capable of inducing big conformational changes. The source code is available. It's a series of Python scripts that run Amber, tested on Mac and Linux, so the code is available. There's some great images, and so that's my second link of the week, because I just thought it was so cool.
Hey, very neat. All right, so my link of the week is a rehash. Since you gave two good links, I'll give a rehash of an old link, and it's actually the link to PyCon 2009's talks. I know I had used a link of the week where I linked to the Brightkite site or Bright Cove site, but somebody from the Python Software Foundation actually sent me this link in response to a question I had on some news group. And this is basically a schedule with the, if you go to us.pycon.org/2009/conference/schedule, you can basically get the entire schedule with the slides and a link to the video right embedded into the schedule. So it's a wonderful way for anybody who wants to know about anything and everything that went on. You can look at the slides and listen to the audio and video of the talk all in one place. And I've been actually doing a lot of Python coding lately, and thanks to this very good interface, which is just a table, I basically caught on a lot of stuff that I'd missed, you know, using like Brightcove and so on. So that's my link of the week, us.pycon.org/2009/conference/schedule.
Excellent. You can always find Coast to Coast Bio on FriendFeed. We have a room there where we put up our links. We have a delicious site. Some of you, Chris Lasher especially, have been sending us links for :C2C bio, if you could tag items with that on Delicious. That's our primary source of finding stuff. And you can get us from on iTunes, or which is the best way to get us, or from spokenword.org, which you can use as a front end to iTunes as well. It's a great site that I like using. And you can always email us at hurry@bioscreencast.com. Or drop us a line on our friend feed room. We always like hearing from you. And do you have anything else, Hari?
No, that's about it. So, yeah, and we can probably give our Twitter handles out in case there's actually people out there who haven't yet followed us on Twitter. Mine's HARIJAY.
And mine's MNDOCI. It's MNDOCI everywhere online.
Yeah, same here. I'm Hari J everywhere too.
So with that, I guess we'll talk again next week and become a little better with being more regular for the next few weeks.
Yeah, I think we're all done with traveling, so that should be entirely doable now.
Speak for yourself. I'm heading on the road again in 2 days.
Oh, yeah, sorry. I am entirely done with travel for a while now. And all our synchrotron trips are now remote. So, you know, okay. I don't travel anymore. So.
Okay. Lovely.
Awesome. Great. All right. Yeah. Cool. Yeah. Cheers.
Bye-bye.